The man that's going to speak for us this morning, I got to meet briefly. I didn't get to spend a whole lot of time with him, but from what I understand and just seeing him in his countenance and the way he carries himself, that he's going to give us a good message. So I'll turn the meeting over to Scotty from Midland, Texas.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Keith. I'm either going to have to lean down or talk up, I guess. You know, before I got here, I had to make a decision on whether to go to the bathroom or not. And right now, I know I made the wrong decision. First, I want to thank the committee that saw fit to invite me to this 36th annual Kentucky State Conference. I certainly appreciate it. It's quite an honor, and I will always appreciate all of the friends that I met and how gracious you were to me and my wife. When I got off the plane, we were looking, trying to figure out how we were going to get here, and there's a pretty little girl named Casey with a sign that said, "Welcome to Kentucky." And we knew we were home. We got here, and Larry brought over a basket of fruit and made us feel very comfortable, and I want to thank you all for that. You know, my name is Scotty Alcorn, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, folks. By the grace of God, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 710 group of Midland, Texas, I haven't had a drink containing alcohol since June the 9th of 1963, for which I'm extremely grateful. You know, a lot of places, when you give your dry date, they think you're bragging. But in our group, we always do it so we can all stay awake for the young, fresh, new, energetic talk and sleep through the old-timers' talk. You know, an old boy with 10 years will get up to talk and everybody will go for coffee. One time they asked an old boy in our group named Jim Sadler how you get to be an old-timer. And he said, "It's real easy. You don't drink and you don't die." And that's all there is to it. You know, I mentioned my wife's name's Blanche, and she always travels with me. She's sitting in the back, and she goes with me wherever I go. She's kind of my group conscience. One time we were out in Las Vegas, and we were wandering around. She went in the other room of this casino, and I went in there to play the slot machines. And one of these ladies of the evening walked up to me and said, "Hello, big boy." Said, "How would you like to play around?" And I said, "No, I don't believe so." And she said, "Oh, come on and be a sport." Now, not that I was interested, but my curiosity got the best of me. And I said, "Lady, how much do you charge for your services?" And she said, "What do you think I'm worth?" And I said, "Oh, about $10. And she got indignant as hell and walked off and left me. Well, the next morning, Blanche and I came down on the elevator and stepped out in the lobby, and the same girl was standing there. She looked at me. She looked at Blanche. She said, "See what you get for $10? Now, I want to tell you something. I told that story over in North Carolina. And when I got through, this little old lady walked up to Blanche and said, "I think that's terrible." his talking about you like that. And Blanche said, and I quote, "Oh, don't worry, he was the only one I charged." Before I came up here, somebody handed me some announcements here. The manager of the Blue Ridge Convention Center said, in case of fire, would all Al-Anons remain seated till the alcoholics are clear of the building? I hope you will comply. My gosh, there are people sitting. I better go ahead and scratch. They're behind me back here. I'm not used to that. Well, let's see. It says here, Jack Sullivan is opening a halfway house for girls that won't go all the way. Is there a Mr. Moore? A Mr. Moore here? Oh, yeah. There's a lady in room 1134 hollering for more. Let's see here. Let's see what... A man walked in a doctor's office and said, "I can't pee." The doctor said, "How old are you?" He said, 93. The doctor said, "You've peed enough." Okay. Here's another announcement. Lost a small three-legged dog, one eye missing, his left ear chewed off, recently castrated, answers to the name Lucky. Now, folks, this is the spiritual side of this program. You know, one time there were two little boys, two nice little boys named Jimmy and Johnny. And they decided they were going to learn how to cuss like the big people. So they thought and they thought. Little Jimmy says, "You know, the worst word I ever heard was hell." Johnny says, "Oh, my gosh, the nastiest word I ever heard was ass." So that night they went to bed and they thought and they practiced saying those words, and the next morning they went in for breakfast. Their mother said, "Jimmy, what would you like for breakfast?" And he said, "Hell, I believe I'll have some oatmeal." She picked him up and tanned his hide and threw him back down that chair and looked at Johnny and said, "What do you want?" He said, "You can bet your ass I don't want any of that oatmeal." Well, let's see. Here's one. A dry drunk is when you don't wet the bed. Damn, it's hard to stay sober with stuff like this. Well, as I said before, my name's Scotty and I'm an alcoholic. But my real name is John Scott. My mother named me John after the toilet and Scott after the tissue. And that's why I'm an alcoholic. Now, you all can sit around in your one-on-one and easy does it groups and try to figure out why you're an alcoholic, but I already know and I don't worry about it anymore. And it all started where I grew up, in northern Oklahoma, a little town called Ponca City. And I was of a family, I had two older sisters, and I grew up and I was always tall, so when my cousin went to school, they just sent me with him. And I was just barely five and started on through school. Nothing particular happened until I was about 13 years old, and two things happened in my life that affected me from then on. One of them, that I was sent on up to high school. I got out of junior high and I was 13 years old. I was real tall, but I was an emotional midget, and I was very affected by people around me, and then my father died, and that left me with no masculine parental care, and so I was very influenced by my peers and all the big boys in school, and I wanted to be part of them, and so I just went along with that. One time when I was a sophomore, we got together, about five of us, and got a half a gallon or a gallon jug of Sweet Lucy wine for $1.75, and went down the Arkansas River, and we all drank till we either threw up or passed out or both. It didn't make much difference which. The next day was Saturday, and we all got downtown and hang around the Rexall drugstore, and those other four boys vowed to never do that again, and I vowed to do it better. Right then, I should have realized that I was different than most people around me when it came to alcohol. I had tasted the magic elixir. At 13 years old, it made me stronger. It made me better looking. It made me more intelligent. It made me be able to talk to people. Inhibitions to the wind. It made me think that I could talk to the girls. Everything I wanted was in that bottle. And I enjoyed it. And I looked forward to it. And I associated drinking with fun, as we all do. Well, I went on through high school and did a little more experimental drinking, and that's about it. When I got out of high school, World War II started. And for any of you that are familiar, that pretty well changed things as to the small country boys going to the big city. And I learned how to drink in the Navy with the big boys. And as long as you were rather passive and didn't cause any trouble when you got drunk, the SPs would take you back to ship or your base, and there wasn't any harm caused. We just went on with it. I got out of the service and went to the University of Oklahoma on the GI Bill. And all the time I was in college, I was on the silver cure. That's when you drink till you run out of money. And I didn't ever have much money, so I didn't have an opportunity to drink very much. Oh, we'd drink some of this old green beer. I think it's called Silver Fox beer. The fox was still in it. You were afraid to sneeze in public because bad things had happened when you drank that beer. Well, I graduated rather uneventfully from the University of Oklahoma with a degree in geological engineering. They sent me to the oil fields of West Texas, to a town called Midland, Texas. This was in 1950, and I've lived there ever since. And in Midland, the area, in the oil country, it's pretty expanded out there, and we handled all the drilling of wells in West Texas and southeast New Mexico. And I was sent over to Hobbs, New Mexico, to watch some oil wells being drilled over in that area. Now, I want to tell you about Hobbs. One time, there was a contest, and the first prize was a week's vacation in Hobbs, and second prize was 2 weeks' vacation in Hobbs. But this was a good old oil field town, and it was two-fisted drinking, and I started learning how to oil field drink. It's pretty well condoned if you could do your work and get it taken care of. So I started drinking pretty heavy and learning how to work with a hangover. About that time, I went back to Oklahoma and married this young lady and brought her down to Midland, Texas. And after about a year, we had a daughter by that marriage. And I wasn't ready for the responsibility of husbandhood and fatherhood and do what you should and get home when you could. And I refused to accept the responsibility of that marriage and that family. And as a result of my actions, we dissolved that marriage. My wife took our daughter and went back to Oklahoma, and that was the end of that. I decided that I could live the way I was accustomed to wanting to live. That somewhere along the line, I felt as though the world owed me a living, and I was going to get after it. I had no more responsibility. Hell, it was just hard enough to get to work without worrying about family and all that crap. So I went on and I moved in with this fella who was a heavy drinker. Now, those are the worst kind. I'm not talking about alcoholics. I'm talking about heavy drinkers. This old boy would say, "You know what? I think tonight I'll go out, get a jug and tie one on, make an ass out of myself, probably fall down and come stumbling home." And he'd do it. And the next evening he'd say, "I think I'll just have a couple of beers and have a sandwich and go to bed early." And he'd do that too. I'd say, "I think I'll just have a couple of beers with you," and I'd be knee-walking drunk by dark. I never could figure out what was going on. And I'd make all these bold promises and ideas and things. I'd just get twisted off. I remember one time, he and I were going to a party. It was about 6 o'clock one evening. And we were invited over to this nice party at these people's house. You know, and they were having dips and chips and finger sandwiches and all that. I decided I didn't want to go to that stuffy old party drunk. I'd better get started early. So I started drinking, and when I got there, I was way ahead of everybody. I came in and shook hands with the host and tripped over his feet and sat down backwards in a great big bowl of guacamole dip. Now, that was all right till the next day I went to the cleaning shop and tried to explain to that cleaning lady what that was. And she didn't know from which direction that guacamole dip had come. One time we were having a party to repay some people, and we had got a case of beer and some old booze. Gonna have hamburgers and hot dogs. And this fellow walked out in the kitchen that I was living with, and he caught me over in the corner, and I had this bottle. He said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm having a little drink." He said, "Why don't you go out in the living room and have a drink with the guests?" I said, "Oh, I don't know. I just thought maybe I was getting a little behind. I didn't want them to get ahead of me. I thought I'd have one out here." He said, "I can't understand this. This is your party, your house, and your whiskey, and you're out here in the kitchen stealing drinks from yourself." He said, "Something's the matter with you. Why in the world are you doing that?" And I said, "I don't know. It just seemed like the thing to do." Did it ever just seem like the thing to do? I don't know of any drunk that gets up in the mornings without having the best intentions for that day that he could possibly have. I didn't want people getting mad at me. I didn't want people thinking I was crazy. I didn't want to make an ass out of myself and alienate people. But the things I did just seemed like the thing to do. Well, this old boy decided that he didn't quite want to run in the crowd I ran in. I was going down and thought it was up. And I was attending a little raunchier places than he was. And so we just quit socializing together. And about this time in my life, I was taking better jobs for less pay. It afforded me the opportunity to drink a little better and have more time on my hands. And I started hanging out in this place. I think everybody has their old watering hole that they used to go to. And in Midland, we had a place lovingly called the Club Samoa. And I'll tell you how urbane this place was. It had a 50-cent cover charge to keep out the riffraff. And the restrooms were always out of order by 9 p.m. But I could go out there and I felt comfortable. And I didn't feel like I was standing out in a crowd if I happened to get too much to drink. It was kind of a combination beer joint and honky tonk, so there was always something going on around there. And I'd be sitting up at the bar drinking this old Pearl beer, big old long neck brown bottle, drinking Pearl beer and sitting there, and all of a sudden I'd, and the froth would come up in my mouth, you know. And I'd say, whoops, I better eat something here. And I'd reach down at the end of the bar, and they always had this great big jar of pickle weenies. And there was a purple hard-boiled egg floating in there and a couple of Miller moths. And I'd reach down in that formaldehyde and pull one of those suckers out, shake it like a thermometer and pop that down and chase it with Pearl beer, and man, that was living. My breath would peel paint 5 feet away. I'd go up and ask some old gal to dance. I'd say, how about it, honey? It's good. Gosh, get away. But I used to hang out there because I could write checks. And I knew they weren't good, and the bartender named Skeets knew they weren't good. But he knew that I couldn't write drunk checks anywhere else in town, so on payday, he knew I'd come by and pick them up. And then we'd sit and argue as to whether that was my signature or not. Finally, he said, I got it figured out. I'd write the check, and he'd just sign it. So we'd always know whose was mine. And I kept rocking along like this, and things kept getting worse. And it just kept, started falling in on me, and sometime in my life, right about now, the worst bugaboo that ever comes over an alcoholic started engulfing me. I'm talking about that feeling of loneliness. I mean that gut feeling that hits you right here and it won't go away. You're so lonely. Nobody understands. You want to do well and you can't. You just cry out, you're so lonely. I know Al-Anons feel it too. Here they are, trying to hold a family together and lying through their teeth to the neighbors about their husbands. Their children are wondering why, and they don't have any answer. Alcoholism causes loneliness to anybody that's accepted around it. It's the worst bugaboo we have that ties us together. you can hear an alcoholic talk, and when he starts talking about loneliness, you know where he's coming from. And I was experiencing this, and it wouldn't go away. I wanted to do what I could. I remember I used to go up to my mother's to visit. My daughter would arrange to be over at her house, and I'd stay there on the wagon and try to do the very best I could, and I knew I didn't fit there. I didn't fit anywhere. And I'd stay on the wagon for about 4 or 5 days, and it was just absolutely miserable. I'd go back home, and I knew, going back home to Midland, Texas, and I knew life was not going to get any better. I didn't see any out for me. There was no hope. It was fear of the future and so much remorse for the past. And I didn't know where to turn or what to do. I remember one time, it was on New Year's Eve, in the Midland paper and on the radio, they announced that any time if you had too much to drink, call the police department and they would come and get you and take you home, no questions asked. Well, in April, I called them again. And I was out at the Samoa. And usually this real good old boy, this cop, would come in and take care of me and get me home and see that I got in all right. And this particular time, I got the wrong cop. And we're riding along. The first thing he said, "Don't puke in the car now, damn it." He said, "Scotty, we've been talking down at the police station, and we've been decided that we're no longer going to run a taxi service for you. From now on your own." He just drove up, pushed me out, and drove off. Very rude. My roommate that week told me that he just had to move away. He said, "I just can't stand living with you." He said, "I think you're going crazy." He said, "I can't help you. You just are just something's the matter. I think you need psychiatric help." And about that time, as it always is, my job was terminated. And I had absolutely no place to go. I'd been kicked out of the house, had no job, nothing to do, and the cops wouldn't even pick me up. So I was going to pack up and go up to Oklahoma to Mama. A 37-year-old man was going to go home to Mama. Every time I think about it, I just cringe. Because my mother had told everybody that I was the son she always wanted, that I was the one I'd gotten a college education, and I had a good job, and I was doing the best I could, and she was real proud of me, and she never admitted to her friends that I was a louse. I was a figment of her imagination. And she would never give in. And here I was going home to humiliate her because I couldn't take care of myself. I got the car packed and went out to Club Samoa to say goodbye and got drunk all over again. And I was living in this little cold water hotel. And I got up that morning and went down to the pool hall to have a chili dog for breakfast. And the bartender says, "Scotty, I don't know if you knew it, but Jim P has done joined A and A. And he's got 4 months sobriety. Hell, I hadn't even missed him. Well, I'll tell you about Jim. Jim P., well, his name's Jim Puckett. Hell, he knows his name. Why shouldn't you? Well, old Jim was the kind of guy that I hoped was at the party or the beer joint or wherever I went, because he was so terribly obnoxious that I could hide under the umbrella of his drunkenness and they wouldn't even notice me. And I love for Jim to be there because we could all sit and talk about him. And Jim had joined A and A. And I got to thinking about it, and I mulled that over all evening while I drank. And I always liked to drink beer because I thought I could last longer. I'd just go down like the Titanic when I drank whiskey, and I just hated that. So that night I was crying in my cups and everything else, and the next morning I made a decision, and I called Jim. And he said, come on over, and I went over there. I walked in, and I told Jim that I had a problem. And before I could even say anything, he started jabbering. He started talking about the big book and the Serenity Prayer and the 12 steps and the 12 traditions and Dr. Bob and Uncle Bill and the little red wagon. And I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. You ever notice a guy with 4 months sobriety knows everything there is to know about AA? And he was going to tell me. And I sat there, and the more he talked, the more confused I got at what he was talking about, but it didn't make any difference. The tears started running down my cheeks. And he just kept talking. And I realized that finally somebody gave a damn. Somebody cared about me and that I had a problem. Because up until this time, I had attempted to thrive on pity. I wanted people to feel sorry for me. And I was a pitiful person. And it had gone past pity into contempt. People were just sick and tired of me. And finally, Jim Puckett gave a damn what happened to me. He said, Scotty, you don't look very good at all. Maybe we ought to get you some orange juice and honey. I said, ooh. God, that's the worst thing I'd ever heard of, orange juice and honey. I want to tell you, when I drank, I threw up a lot. As a matter of fact, I was real good at throwing up. Now, I learned in Norfolk, Virginia, when I was wearing these little white sailor suits, and the city police in Norfolk didn't appreciate sailors being drunk. They had a sign on the courthouse lawn that said, sailors and dogs keep off the grass. So I'd be walking down the street and I had to learn how to throw up in those whites. So I'd be walking down, I just I wouldn't even bend over. I just... Somebody in a car would walk by and say, "What the hell was that?" I remember one time I was in this beer joint on Main Street in Norfolk, Virginia, and you walk in there in the restroom to keep it kind of aired out instead of a window. They just had bars on it with a hog wire screen. Well, I went in there and it was real crowded one day, and I just right through that hog wire screen. And it would have been all right if I hadn't been eating spaghetti. Well, it caused a hell of a commotion in that men's room. And naturally, I run out to the bartender and said, "Somebody puked in there." I remember out at the Club Samoa, I used to be sitting around out there on that stool becoming rather obnoxious and making an ass out of myself and solving the problems of the world. And some old boy would be sitting there and he'd take offense. He always did, you know, and he'd say, "You son of a bitch, come outside, I want a piece of you." So we'd go outside. He'd square off. I'd just throw up. Nobody ever hit a man while he was throwing up. He'd say, "Good God Almighty, get the hell out of here." I'd go back inside and he'd say, "You stay away from me." Well, you see, I didn't want any orange juice and honey. Because honey doesn't go. Honey won't let go. So he said, "Well, I got to get you something to eat anyway. You look like you're dehydrated." So we went down and he got me some scrambled eggs and dry toast. And I did have some orange juice. And he started talking about there was an AA meeting that night. Now, this was 1963, and the only thing I knew about AA, or Alcoholics Anonymous, was in 1962 I had seen a movie called The Days of Wine and Roses. It featured Jack Lemmon and Lee Remick. And Jack Lemmon was an alcoholic, and he did things badly, and every time he'd do it, somebody'd come by and put him in a straitjacket and talk to him, and then they'd take him to a room and he'd sat down with people that didn't look like they were having very much fun. And I figured that when you joined AA that you would hire somebody to follow you around, and when you got drunk, they'd take care of you and bring you back. So Jim said, "I'm going to AA tonight. Would you like to go?" And I said, "Jim, I'm a little short of money. I don't think I can join anything right now." Now, I'm telling you the truth. He got to talking, and we got to visiting around about it, and he realized what was going through my mind.
A name Joe Clary.
He's our self-appointed sergeant-at-arms. Now, I want to tell you about Joe. I think he came in 1961, and he's the guy that's always there. He's seeing that the coffee's made, sells the grapevines, turns on the heater or the air conditioner, sees that the ashtrays are emptied, and he greets every new person that comes in that door. Every group needs a Joe Clary. Well, Joe grabbed me, gave me a scalding cup of coffee filled to the brim, and I had the shakes, and introduced me to 30 people faster than I've ever been introduced in my life. When the meeting started, we went, and they put me on the front row down there with Jim on one side, Joe on the other. And I didn't know what was going on. Some old boy got up there and showed off by reading and talking and saying a bunch of stuff. And about that time, they said, "We'll have a moment of silent meditation. Would you please bow your head?" So I bowed my head, and it got real quiet in there, and my stomach went, and I looked around, and people were taking turns pointing and waving at me. Nice to see you. Oh, yeah. Oh. Well, they called on this guy, and the first guy they called on, the great big rotund bald-headed guy named Neil, and he had 12 years sobriety. And he gets up and he says, "Well, all I know about this program is if you don't take a drink, you can't get drunk." I said, "Hell, I know that." "Well, I've been here about 3 weeks. I'll lay something on them." Well, you know, that goofy guy walked back and sat down and got a standing ovation. "Atta boy, Neil. Tell him how it is, Neil." Man, he's a bunch of bastards around here. Well, the next guy they call on is a fella named Monty with bib overalls. And he gets up there real shy, and he's got 19 months of sobriety. 18 months of it was spent in the Texas State Penitentiary. And I thought, well, this is rather novel. Well, I got to listen and tolerate no Monty and thought, well, let's pacify this poor fella. Except all of a sudden, I started listening to what Monty was saying. And he started talking about love. And he started talking about gratitude. And he started talking about honesty. And sharing. And caring. And acceptance. Here is a guy with absolutely nothing going for him, and he's talking about how great this world is because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought, by golly, if Monty can make it, I'll darn sure give it a try. The next guy they called on was a big book quoter. And he'd get up, and every time he'd say something, he'd say, "And in the big book." And he'd hold that pose. And you notice, the longer they're sober, the longer they hold the pose. "In the big book." And I looked down the hall where he was pointing, and there's this door. And I could envision in there that they had a candelabra and a kneeling bench and the big book. And if I got to stay around there a while, maybe I could get an appointment and they would let me in that room to read the big book. Well, you know, in about a week, I got enough nerve to open that door, and it was the damn furnace. Now, I want to tell you, this has got a cover on it, but this is the big book. It's not the good book, but it is good. It was published in 1939 by our 100 founding fathers. The words were written in perpetuity, and I defy anybody, after all these years, to find one thing that's out of date in the big book. Well, they got through with that meeting, and they pulled out these little wicker baskets and said, "If you don't have a dollar, take one." And I wanted one. But I didn't have enough nerve, so I just stuck my hand in there and shuffled those dollars around like the guy next to me, and we passed it on. We got all through, and they said, "We will now stand up, join hands, and say the Lord's Prayer." We stood up and joined hands, and it got real quiet all over again. And in Texas, we talk real slow. And when we pray, there are gaps in the Lord's Prayer. And you could hear the sound of silence. And as we prayed, there were 31 drunks in that room holding hands praying to God. And I got so overwhelmed, because right there in an AA clubhouse with 31 lousy drunks, the hand of God touched me on the shoulder. And to this day, I have not had a drink of whiskey since. I don't know if people have spiritual awakenings or spiritual experiences that they can identify, but I'll never forget that as long as I live. Jim invited me to move in with him until I could get things going. So we got my stuff and went over there. The next night we were going to another meeting. And it was a step night, the fourth step. And we were going to take a searching and fearless moral inventory, and I didn't even know where my clothes were. And Jim says, "Well, I got a little off track yesterday because you came over, but well, I'll get back on. I've got to go by and pick up my baby." And I said, "Ooh, yeah, uh-huh." He said, no, you got this wrong. Now, in AA, we call them babies or pigeons. Some people call them that. And what we do, we bring these people in and nurture them, try to get them started on the right track and assist them into getting to AA, getting their minds out of hock. And sometimes they choose us to be their sponsors, and we just look after them. And I've got to go get some of these people that I do this for. Jim had 4 months sobriety. So the first one we went by to pick up was a lady named Wanda. Weird Wanda. Wanda had 3 months sobriety, and she had read the big book and gone clear past that, gone into sobriety and beyond, and was reading palms and tea leaves. So Wanda gets in the back seat, and he said, all right, we got to go out and pick up Bill. Well, Bill has 2 months sobriety, and he's an ex-prize fighter, and he goes like this a lot. The phone had rang, and he'd go a couple of rounds. Well, they put Bill in the back seat with the palm reader, and we're off and running. And he says, well, there's one more I got to pick up. So we go by this house, and there's this young lady, pretty young girl, 20 years old, named Rosalie. She's got 1 month sobriety. Now, I had never... In 1963, this is, I had never seen anybody under the influence or the problem with pills. Rosalie floated out to the car. She had a great big lavender. Her hair was lavender and is in a great big bouffant, and gnats were flying around her. And everything you'd say, she'd say, all right. You'd say, how are you, Rosalie? All right. Get in the car, Rosalie. All right. So they put Rosalie in the back seat with Bill and the palm reader, and we're off and running. Okay. There are five of us in this car, and there's 10 months and 1 day sobriety. We're riding along, all of us looking out the window, and we look like a tree full of owls in that car. Jim had a great big old Lincoln with a dent in the door and a hubcap missing. You always notice that around AA groups, all the hubcaps are missing. Well, we get down to the group. We all get out of the car, and Jim walks in first like the Pied Piper with four of us behind him. All the old-timers look up from the gin rummy table and say, I bet not a damn one of them make it. Now, the reason I'm telling this story is for the new people that might be in this group. You see, Jim had 4 months sobriety and he had four babies. Now, the next time that you might be around your club and the phone rings and somebody needs help, and you don't have time to run and get Tom or Jack or Larry or somebody, you might be it. You might be the only big book that that person on the other end of the phone will ever see. And as long as you're sober, like it or not, You represent the program of Alcoholics Anonymous by being sober. And carry that responsibility with you. We are responsible. When you go out to see somebody and you don't know what to say and you're new, tell them why you came to your second meeting. You don't have to tell them why you came to your first. You're a drunk. That's why you came to your first. But what was it there that got you back to that second meeting? You see, you've got maybe the length of sobriety they understand. I understood 4 months of scared sobriety from Jim because he was still hurting and he talked my language. And he got me. And the guy with the overalls, Monty, talking from the heart. I think it says the language of the heart. It's the person who gives the message. You know, a lot of times now I can't go out and make effective 12-step calls because the younger, newer people just don't quite accept an old gray-haired guy walking in and thinking that I'm going to lecture to him. And I've become less effective as the time goes on. And it's up to the new people in AA to carry the message. The young take care of the young. The old take care of the coffee. Bring them in, I'll guarantee you we'll love them. That's the way it works. Well, I got to rocking along and I got a job as a result of being in AA, a professional job. And I was living with Jim, and what I was doing, I was going to meetings, going home and going to bed, getting up and going to work, going to meetings, going to bed. Life got rather repetitious. And I decided I needed a little diversion in my life. The romantic side of my life was lacking. So one night I decided to go over to the Al-Anon room and scout around and see if I could find the right one. And lo and behold, I walked in, and there was Blanche. She had left a bad, bad drunk up in Arkansas and come down to Texas to get rid of him and pick up the wreckage of her past and try to do the best she could by going to Al-Anon. She'd moved down and was living with a friend and a friend's husband till she could get straightened out. Here she was, all alone, with a 4-year-old boy under one arm and an Al-Anon book under the other, trying to do the very best she could. And I walked up and said, "Hi." And she didn't want anything to do with another drunk. Man, she was a smart ass. Well, this was in August, and we kept rocking along, and I kept sniffing around that old gal trying to get in there. And about October, we had a Halloween dance. So I invited her. We had it down at the AA club, and I said, "How'd you like to go to the dance?" And she said, "Fine, I'll bring my own car." Here I am, 40 years old, and my date's in another car. Well, about 3 weeks later, we got invited up to an eating meeting up about 60 miles north of this little town called La Mesa. We took the program up there, and there was a bunch of us went up there, and Blanche went. And I talked a little bit up there. I had a couple years sobriety, and I just filled in a spot. And coming back, she let me hold her hand. Evidently, she thought that I was trying to be honest and clean up the wreckage of my past, and I wasn't a high-rolling drunk anymore. But we started going together, and about a year and a half later, they had down in Texas what they call the Lake Brownwood AA Conference. Lakeside, it's at a lakeside retreat, a Christian church camp. And it was a very spiritual setting for an AA conference. And we were all down there and on the church grounds, and that Saturday night, this old boy got up, gave a very spiritual AA talk. I mean, one of those water walkers. He got all through, and we go outside on the grounds, and we're blessing each other and running into tree trunks. Nobody's ever going to drink again, you know. I get blanched down there on a rock by the lake, and there's this church cross up behind her. One thing led to another, and I asked her to marry me, and she said yes. And my stomach went rawr. I thought, what the hell have I gotten myself into? Well, as she is, she ran up and told everybody. So they really start running into tree trunks then. Well, we got married. What's that? We got married in a fever, hotter than a pepper sprout. Well, we got married and we went down to this little chapel where this preacher, he wasn't in AA, but he used to come to the closed meetings and sit on the back row and take notes for his sermons. And, you know, you'd go down there and you could hear your story cleaned up. Well, he married us, and we had the reception at the 710 Club. And we're all running around there and having cake and ice cream. And about that time, some wino in tennis shoes walks in, and they just hand him a piece of wedding cake. They didn't give him orange juice and honey, and he's, hey, this is all right, you know. So we got married, and with God's help, things started happening in our lives. We didn't have any place to live. We found a little old widow woman that wanted to get rid of this house, and if we'd just take up the payments of $104 a month, we could have it. And furniture started showing up. And the van, coffee table, bed, washing machine, chrome dinette set. We even got a damn dog. Hell, the dog was goofier than the lady that gave it to us. And we're sitting there trying to have an AA marriage, doing the best we can. And about that time, one evening, the phone rings. And I pick it up, and the voice to the other end is my 14-year-old daughter from way back in the past of that mess of my life. The summer before, she had visited Blanche and me, and she called up and she said, I talked it over with my mother. And my mother said I could come down and live with you all and have a life like you have. Alcoholics Anonymous. She came down. We had one daughter one son, one wife, one husband, one dog. We all went by the same name, for richer, for poorer, for better, or for worse. And to this day, after 21 years, we have never allowed the word stepchild used in our house. Well, my daughter went on and finished high school. We were fortunate enough to send her to college. She got a degree at Texas Tech University, got married, which has since been dissolved. I don't have to practice tolerance with that bastard anymore. Our son went on up to Texas Tech, graduated. He was in the oil business and got caught in the energy crunch, and he's back in Midland now, going into the brokerage business. We feel very comfortable about our family. We're very close-knit. And it's all because of the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. We try to get things straightened out before it gets out of hand. The tenth step. You know, one time I came home when my son was in high school. He was about 16 years old, and he was taking chemistry at the high school. And I went out in the backyard, and he was sitting down there with a hammer, driving worms into the ground with his hammer. I said, "What in the world are you doing?" He said, "Well, we mixed up this concoction in chemistry class, and you can take a drop and put it on a worm, and it'll make it just like a nail." I said, "Uh-huh." I said, "Son, I'll tell you what. You give me that potion and I'll buy you a Thunderbird." He said, "Okay." So the next morning he came in the living room, looked out the window, and in the driveway was a brand new Cadillac. And I said, "What do you think?" And he said, "I thought you said you were going to get me a Thunderbird." I said, "I did. It's in the garage. The Cadillac's from your mother." Well, let's see. Here's one. A drunk woke up after the San Francisco earthquake and said, "How am I going to pay for this?" A lady ran up to Catholic Church. The woman said to the priest, "Is mass out?" And he said, "No, but your hat's on crooked." You know, we've been listening to Tom here, old Tom Pack, all week, and I want to tell you a little story about him. You know, he's recently retired, so he decided to go down to apply for Social Security. So he went down there and filled out all the forms, and he went up to the lady, and she said, "Well, do you have your birth certificate with you?" He said, doggone it, I forgot it. I don't know, it might be home somewhere. And she said, well, before we can process these forms, do you happen to have your driver's license so we can get your age? He said, oh, my gosh, I must have left my billfold at home. He said, well, do you have anything to show proof of age? He said, wait just a minute. So he undid his shirt and unbuttoned it and showed her the white hair on his chest. She says, well, my gosh, anybody with white hair is bound to qualify for Social Security. So she went ahead and filled the forms out and said, bring all the rest in later. He went home and told Emmy Lou about it. Said, I got all mixed up down there and I didn't have my birth certificate or my driver's license. And I had to take my shirt off and show them the white hair on my chest to qualify for Social Security. She said, why didn't you drop your pants and go for full disability? You know, I've been around AA a lot. And here a while back, I started making notes of things and little phrases that are catchy in AA. And you've heard them. And I just decided to kind of keep up with them. See if you've heard this one. The future lies ahead. Now, where in the hell would it lie? Bob L. from Midland, I just wanted to stay alive until I die. Ray B. from Hogansville, Georgia, said, God doesn't love you because you're good. God loves you because he's good. That's all right. Dr. Dave A. from Dallas. If you can't practice these principles in all your affairs, you'd better get rid of some of your affairs. Beverly R., an Al-Anon from Fort Worth. Practicing alcoholics don't marry, they take hostages. Lenore Cruz from Midland. Insecurity is better than no security at all. And Buck D. from Arlington, Virginia. If you like everyone in AA, you're not going to enough meetings. You know, one time in our group, we've got a little guy, cranky little old boy named Abe. And old Abe has got about 14, 15 years, and he's had two bypasses, and his health's in terrible shape. And one time he came up to me and gave me a plaque just to have by my bed. And every morning when I get up, I read that plaque. And it says, please, Lord, teach us to laugh again, but God, don't ever let us forget that we cried. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. You know, they say if you can't remember your last drunk, you haven't had it. Well, I shared what I hope is my last drunk and my only story with you. And if you had a few laughs out of it, we're all richer for it. Because at the time when it was happening to me, it was anything but funny. I came in and I took this program to heart. And one time I was down in El Paso and I was going to talk. And I was very serious at the time because life was very serious to me. And my wife gave me a note before I went on stage that said, life is too important to be taken seriously. And I've attempted to live my life that way every time. You know, I certainly appreciate the opportunity to share with you. I enjoy the hospitality of the Kentucky warmth. I got one more here. Says John Daniels is trisexual. He'll try sex with anything that walks or flies. What is AA? Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may share their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. Most of us have never met before, but we've been friends forever. Now that we've met, let's keep it that way. Thank you.